Hi, and welcome to Guideposts. I'm your volunteer reader, Sandy Summers. Today, we will continue reading the August-September 2024 issue of Guideposts with articles like Choose Joy. Positive People, Choose Joy. Happiness is a gift. Just ask Adrian Sheffield, the Dancing Trash Collector, by Cheryl Smith Rogers, contributing writer. One of the most positive people you'll ever meet does one of the hardest jobs you could ever imagine. Adrian Sheffield is a garbage man. In Austin, Texas, his upbeat, service-oriented approach to his job has made him a beloved celebrity. He's been on local news. The mayor of a nearby suburb presented him with a certificate of recognition for his ability to bring joy to others. Children run outside when they hear his truck coming, eager to catch sight of the man who sings, dances, and even dresses in costume to spread love while doing a job few people want to do. And it's not just any love. Adrian, who turned 40 last year, is a man of longtime faith who says he knows all about God and what he can do. No matter the challenges he's faced, Adrian said God has been there for him, and he wants to share the message of God's love with everyone he meets, from the back of a garbage truck if he has to. The spiritual lesson I hope people will learn is don't give up, Adrian says. Life challenges do come. Stay strong and don't give up on the Lord because he will see you through. Adrian is a sanitation worker for Texas Disposal Systems, a private company that provides waste removal and processing services to Austin area communities. 6 days a week, Adrian and a driver pilot a garbage truck through city neighborhoods and haul trash from up to 1,200 homes. It's brutal work, especially in summer. Filled with trash, a single plastic garbage bin weighs 60 or 70 pounds, if not more, Adrian says. Over and over, he maneuvers bins from the curb to the truck, then either dumps them himself or attaches them to a mechanical arm to be lifted onto the hopper. After that, he pulls a lever to crush the garbage, and the truck moves on. Adrian rides on the back, standing on a small platform and grabbing a handle. All day, he hops on and off the truck, slings bins, and puts them back by the curb. He arrives at the sanitation yard at 6 a.m. and usually clocks out 12 hours later, after he and his partner empty the truck at a waste processing facility. When it gets hot, like 100 degrees, and you try to do this, a lot of guys just quit, he says. To help new employees stay on the job, Adrian trains them, showing them the workings of the truck and giving them pointers on how to lift heavy bins and build their stamina. Starting out, Adrian was one of those employees who wanted to quit. I hated it the first day, he says. Sanitation is one of America's most hazardous industries. Workers repeatedly lift heavy loads, are exposed to toxic chemicals, and operate machinery with sharp moving parts. The risk of injury is higher than in mining. Adrian stuck with it because he needed the paycheck. Growing up in Austin, he loved watching garbage haulers leap from their trucks, toss a few cans, and hop back on like it was nothing. Then when I actually experienced it, I was like, oh man, this is so tiring, he said. Adrian realized that he had a choice. He could hate his job and be miserable, or he could focus on the positive and try to make a difference. With a nudge from God, he chose positivity. I made it so it was fun, he says. I love being outside. No one micromanages you, and you're not stuck in an office. You pick up the trash, and then you go home. To make the work even more fun, he began listening to music and dancing as he zoomed through the city. People noticed. It's not every day you see a garbage man boogieing on the back of a truck and flashing an ear-to-ear grin at everyone he sees. I love seeing you smile, people called out. You just made my day. Adrian remembered running outside as a kid to watch garbage trucks at work. Decades later, kids on his route were just as fascinated. He'd wave to them and stop to show them the truck and let them climb onto the cab and honk the horn. Parents came out to thank him. That's when Batman came about, he said. Adrian knew his youngest fans would flip out if they saw one of their favorite superheroes pull up to their house. Halloween was approaching, so he bought a Batman costume and wore it on the job. It was crazy, he remembers. Everybody came out to see that. They were filming me and taking pictures. More costumes followed. A bunny on Easter, Santa Claus at Christmas, Spider-Man, a leprechaun, Tigger from Winnie the Pooh. Last Christmas, he switched things up and donned a Grinch costume. "I won't take your toys, but I will take that trash," he said as he pulled up to houses. The costume landed on local news. "These kids are like my family," Adrian told the news crew. "That's what keeps me going." Adrian admits that sanitation work and his life is not always easy. He and his two sisters were raised by a single mother who still looks out for him. "My mom is a strong woman," he said. "I look up to her. I feel a strong responsibility to take care of her." Adrian works extra shifts to earn additional money, and even then he still finds it hard to make ends meet. He's also had all the usual ups and downs of romantic relationships and financial setbacks. When he talked to Guidepost, he was going through one of his low periods. "Feels like everything has started coming down on me," but he was quick to pivot to the strength he gets from his faith. "I look at it as God getting me ready for whatever he has in store for me," he said. "I think God is growing me up and preparing me for something great. Right now it's not my season, but I know it's coming. I'm just praying and staying positive." And he's still spreading the love from the back of his garbage truck. This Easter, he hadn't felt up to putting on the bunny costume, but he bounced back. Talking to Guideposts a month later, he was already planning his 4th of July outfit. Maybe Captain America to come back with a bang, or an American flag cape with flag sleeves and flag socks. When the Austrian suburb of Georgetown gave Adrian a certificate of recognition last year for his positive influence on the community, he was stunned to see a crowd gathered at the city council meeting to cheer for him. "That was an amazing day," he says. "I think my faith gives me a heart for other people. I look forward to making people happy. When I see them smile, I say, mission accomplished." Answered prayers. Thank you, Heavenly Father, for answering prayers for our daughter to make her high school team. May her God-given talents and spirit shine and make you proud. Becca. My husband has been promoted. Thanks be to God. Vivian. I found my puzzle piece that I'd been looking for. It was right there, but I didn't see it. I know it's a small request, but God is good. He was there for me. Debbie. Thank you for praying for my pet, Samson. He pulled through with flying colors and is as good as new. Lee. From our readers and website visitors, send your answered prayers to submissions@guidepost.org. No more Mr. Fix-It. Who knew the answer to a common marital problem could come from an animated kids' movie like Frozen 2 by Eric Stark, Brazil, Indiana? I just pushed the button on the coffee maker when my wife walked into the kitchen. "Want a cup?" I asked. "I could use a pick-me-up," Diane said, and plopped down in a chair. "Susan is upset with me. She texted me a few days ago. I read the messages while I was walking the dogs, but when I got back inside, I forgot to respond. It hurt her feelings. Now she says I'm not as good a friend to her as she is to me," she sighed. "I'm sure we'll work it out, but I just feel rotten." "Did you tell her you were out with the dogs when her text came in?" "Of course. I handed her the coffee. You just need to tell her that you were busy and forgot to text her back." "I did." "Well, if you just explained to her what happened." "Don't you think I tried that already?" Diane snapped. "Why are you getting upset with me? I'm only trying to help." "By offering the most obvious suggestions in the world to me," she said. "I don't know what you want me to do, Diane. I'm trying to help you fix your problem." "I don't want you to fix my problem," she said, her voice rising. "I just want you to listen." "I am listening. That's why I'm trying to help." "Your help isn't what I need right now," she said. "But how can I..." I began to argue, then realized this conversation wasn't going anywhere, like quite a few of our conversations lately. "I hope you and Susan work things out," I said. I kissed Diane on the forehead and went upstairs to my home office. "I'm an engineer. My brother and I started our own company that made jet engine components. We sold it to a larger manufacturer. Now I run a small machine shop with a former colleague. I had a lot of work to do, but my mind kept going back to the frustrating conversation with Diane. We've been married 17 years. It's a second marriage for both of us, and we have a great relationship. These days, though, it seemed as if any time she talked to me about a problem she was having and I tried to help, she got mad at me. I didn't know what to do. That evening, I found Diane in the kitchen dicing chicken. She turned to the stove to stir something. All four burners had a pot on them, and both racks in the oven were full too. When all five of our children lived with us, this wasn't unusual. But now that only our youngest son was still at home, it had been a while since our kitchen was this busy. "What are you making?" I asked. "I'm multitasking. I'm making our dinner for tonight, plus I'm getting a head start on a casserole I'm making for our small group at church tomorrow night. Need help? You can set the table." As I grabbed plates from the cabinet, Diane said, "I'm trying to figure out how I'm going to get everything done tomorrow before I need to leave for church. I'm not sure what time to put the casserole in the oven. You need to leave at 5:30, so just count backward for however long it takes to cook." She stopped chopping and shot me a look. "I'm not stupid," she said. "I have a Zoom meeting for work right when the casserole needs to go in the oven. I'm trying to decide if I should bake it earlier in the day and then reheat it before we leave. I'd offer to put it in the oven, but I'll be at the shop tomorrow. I was just planning to meet you at church." "That's fine. I'll figure it out." When I have a lot to do, I write out a schedule for the day to make sure I don't forget anything. "Yeah, thanks. I hadn't thought of that," she said, her sarcasm punctuated with an eye roll. "Why are you annoyed? I'm trying to help." "Sometimes your help comes across like criticism." "What do you mean?" "Your suggestions make me feel as if you think I'm dumb." "I don't think that at all. But if you don't want my suggestions, I don't know how to help." "I just want you to listen," she said, in the voice she uses when she's told our son the same thing a dozen times. Dinner that night was kind of tense. While Diane and our son chatted, I prayed silently. "God, I hate arguing with Diane. Help me understand her better. This is a problem I don't know how to fix, and it's driving me crazy." A few days later, I was babysitting my 2-year-old granddaughter, Sawyer. As she did every time she came over, she asked me to put on her favorite Disney movie, Frozen 2. I was laying on the floor, coloring with Sawyer, barely paying attention to the movie, when I heard someone on the screen say, "I'm here, what do you need?" "Wait a minute, what was that?" Over my granddaughter's objections, I rewound the movie and watched the scene again. Everything was falling apart for Anna, the princess. Things couldn't have been worse for her. Yet the prince, Kristoff, didn't step in and take over. He put his arm around her and said, "I'm here. What do you need?" A simple question with a lot of depth to it. Asking "what do you need" didn't assume that I knew what was best for the other person or that I knew what they wanted. As I said, I'm an engineer, a real Mr. Fix-It. Troubleshooting is my default mode. But now that I thought about it, jumping in with suggestions could end up being more about what I needed, which was to feel useful, than what the other person needed in the moment. Like with Diane, she didn't need me to fix her problems. She was smart, accomplished, and more than capable of solving things on her own. After all, she managed our household for years, juggling our 5 kids, numerous activities, along with her freelance writing career and church and volunteer commitments. The next morning, Diane was sitting on her bed, frowning at her phone. "Ugh, I missed a deadline," she said. "I put it in my calendar wrong." "I'm sure if you just," I started to say, but when I caught myself, I sat down next to her and put my arm around her. "I'm here," I said. "What do you need?" Her eyes widened with surprise. "It's that writing assignment I've been working on. I planned to turn it in on Friday, but my editor just emailed me. Turns out it was due yesterday. I got my dates mixed up." I fought the urge to offer a suggestion. Instead, I said, "Happens to the best of us. I hate when I forget things. It makes me feel like a failure." Diane wasn't looking for suggestions about how to be more organized. She didn't want help, or else she would have asked for it. She just wanted to feel heard. The best way to support her was to listen, as she'd been asking me to do all those other times. "You're not a failure," I said. "Everyone drops the ball once in a while." She nodded. "I know, but my work is important to me. I want to do the best I can." "I understand. You finish that assignment, I'll take care of the dogs." I walked the dogs, then came inside and started the coffee. While I waited for it to brew, I said a quick prayer of gratitude that God had helped me see things through my wife's eyes. For her, fixing problems wasn't loving. Listening was. I would try to do better at that. When I found Diane, she was already at her computer, hard at work. As I handed her the coffee, she glanced up with a smile and thanked me. I knew it was for a lot more than the caffeine boost. I'm Sandy Summers, and you're listening to Guideposts on Sun Sounds of Arizona, a 24-hour reading and information service for people who can't read print due to a disability. If you missed any part of this program, You may access it anytime on demand at www.sunsounds.org. In addition to the bi-monthly Guidepost magazine, each week we may be reading some of Guidepost's other daily devotions or inspiring stories from Guideposts online. New Beginnings, A Teacher's Heart. It was my first teaching job and my last, I'd hoped. Someone had other ideas. By Emily E. Ryan, League City, Texas. It took everything in me not to slam the door behind the last seventh grader who slouched out of my classroom at the end of my first day as a teacher. I collapsed against the wall and did breathing exercises, trying to slow the pounding of my heart. The door opened. I was about to yell, "Classroom closed," when I saw it was my friend Tabitha, who worked in the school office. "So how'd it go?" she asked, her eyes twinkling at my obvious state of defeat. "I can't believe I have to do this all again tomorrow. The first day is always the hardest," she said. "It gets better from here, I promise." I wasn't buying it. "Teaching is exhausting," I said. "And this classroom feels like a prison. I can't escape. I can't be alone. I can't even go to the bathroom when I need to." Tabitha picked up crumpled papers that littered the floor and straightened desks that had shifted every which way, as if they'd settled from the aftermath of an earthquake. "Are you scared being a teacher isn't going to be what you expected?" she asked. I thought back to the first year of college, when I'd had the misguided notion that I wanted an education degree so I could shape young lives and minds and help them fall in love with learning as much as I had. Part of my college training involved time in several classrooms, observing the realities of teaching: impossible standards, disrespectful, sometimes even hostile students, unrealistic demands by administrators, trying to hold on to their jobs, the occasional entitled parent. As soon as I could, I switched my major to English. I had no idea what career that might lead to. The only thing I knew was that I was never going to be a teacher. Now my eyes met Tabitha's. "Worse," I said. "I'm afraid it's exactly what I expected." Tabitha laughed, thinking I was joking, and left. I leaned my head against the wall, shut my eyes, and pleaded, "God, get me out of here." Why had he put me in this situation? Wasn't he supposed to know my every thought, my every need? I was totally unsuited for teaching. I was an introvert who longed for peace, quiet, order. After college, I worked in finance. Now I was married, middle-aged mom of four children under 12. The past 4 years, I'd been writing part-time for a nonprofit ministry. That was my idea of a perfect job: work that did some good in the world, my own private office, time to be home with my kids. Then the nonprofit closed. We couldn't afford for me not to work, but I couldn't find anything that meshed with my kids' schedules. Out of desperation, I applied to be a sub at a private Christian school. One day the principal called. "Our junior high English teacher just quit," he said. "You have an English degree. Are you interested?" I didn't have any other option, and now my first day had confirmed what I decided in college. Teaching wasn't for me. God couldn't get me out of the classroom fast enough. Except he didn't. Day after day, I dragged myself home, drained. My students seemed intent on working my last nerve. I spent hours every evening grading papers and writing lesson plans, with barely any energy left for my own children. My husband heard plenty about how miserable and trapped I felt. I kept my eyes open for other jobs. Nothing materialized. The prospect of having the summer off with my children was the only thing that got me through the rest of the school year. But those 8 weeks of summer break went by in a blink of an eye. Too soon, I was back in the lion's den. I mean, the classroom. Every day was a slog for me. My prayer journal sounded like David's laments and psalms, where I poured out my bitterness and sadness. I tried to follow David's example and trust in the Lord's power. I knew he could deliver me from my situation. Why was he taking so long? Later that school year, I was one of four teachers who chaperoned 54 kids on a field trip to Washington, D.C. What an exhausting experience. I was glad to sink in my seat on the flight home, until the pilot made an announcement: "We'll be flying through severe turbulence. Please remain seated with seatbelts fastened." The few bumps were manageable. I flashed a smile to the student sitting near me, trying to look braver than I felt. Then the plane plummeted like a roller coaster. Kaylee, a red-headed eighth grader across the aisle from me, grabbed my hand, her fingernails digging into my palm. "Mrs. Ryan, will you pray?" she begged. For some reason, the student trusted me. I couldn't let her down. God, we're terrified and we want this to be over, I prayed aloud. Please calm the air around us, steady our nerves, give us courage and peace, and remind us that you are carrying us through every second of this storm. The turbulence didn't go away immediately, but my fear did. Even Kaylee and the other kids around me seemed to exhale in relief. When the plane finally landed, everyone erupted in whoops and cheers. I stepped off the plane feeling an unfamiliar softness toward my students. Instead of wanting to get away from them, I wanted to help them. Back at school, I came to God with a very different request than I had over the past months. Give me the heart of a teacher, I asked. I kept praying that day after day. Without meaning to, I had been kind of a gotcha teacher, expecting my students to grasp concepts the first time I presented them, and making no secret of my disappointment when they struggled. As my attitude shifted, I found myself wanting to meet them where they were, to connect with them as individuals. I started caring about them, praying for them by name, and slowly they responded. They became more attentive, more eager to learn. I read aloud to my students, bringing characters and plot alive for them. What a thrill it was to see them get caught up in a great book. With my encouragement, they began to take risks in their own writing to unleash their creativity. Preparing and planning took even more time than it used to, but it felt as if I was investing not only in my students, but also in myself. I'd assumed I didn't have the right skills or temperament to be a teacher, but I was discovering I could reach my students and do some good right there in the chaos of the classroom. Teaching gave me a sense of joy and fulfillment I'd never experienced tucked away in my quiet private office. One morning, I switched on the lights in my classroom to find it filled with balloons and streamers. Students leaped out from behind my desk. Surprised, they shouted, "Happy birthday!" Behind them, my whiteboard was filled with heartfelt messages. "Best teacher ever. Thanks for being our teacher. We promise to listen and do our work today." God had worked a miracle of change, not so much in my students or my job, but in me. He had given me the heart of a teacher. Spurred on to grow and improve, I took additional training and earned my professional certification, which landed me a job teaching English and language arts at a public junior high school, where I still work today. Teaching is hard work. Being on all day in front of a room full of teenagers remains challenging and sometimes exhausting for this introvert. There are still days when I wonder if I'm connecting with my students, if I'm making a difference. That's when I think about a student named Audrey, who was in my 7th grade class. She didn't enjoy reading, and I struggled to find a book that held her attention. Then she discovered romance novels. I read along with Audrey and asked her open-ended questions. What do you think about the character's choices? How would you approach a situation like this? How has this book changed your relationship goals? She and I had great conversations. I encouraged Audrey to express her feelings freely in a journal. I told her how writing had helped me process my grief after my mother died when I was 10. Still, I couldn't be sure what she would take away after a year in my class. The following fall, Audrey, now an 8th grader, stopped by my room. She was on the girls' volleyball team. Each player had been asked to thank her favorite teacher. "I chose you," she said, and handed me a note. "Dear Miss Ryan," Audrey had written, "I'm so glad that I had you as my English teacher. You showed me how writing could help someone with something they're going through. I never thought I would be a reader, but now I read every day. It's crazy to me that God gave me you at the time I needed you the most. You gave me a sense of comfort and safety. You always made sure to ask if I was okay, especially when I was at my lowest. I will forever be grateful to you." On hard days, I reread Audrey's note. It reminds me that I'm exactly where I'm meant to be, doing what changes lives, especially my own. For more on this story, see Family Room. Everyday Blessings, Nudged by an Angel, by Sabra Ginkanelli. Editor, like so many mornings lately, I wanted to slow down time so I could catch up. As I stepped off the front porch and toward the car, I noticed a porcelain angel figurine lying in the grass. At first, I couldn't figure out where it had come from. Then I realized it must have fallen off the corner shelf just under the porch roof. Years ago, my nephew had added a shelf where the corner column of the porch meets the roof's edge. He said it would be the perfect place to put a special statuette to face the house and bring good energy and keep us safe. I'd set the angel on the high shelf and completely forgotten about it. The figurine had never fallen before, and I wondered how it had come down. I was glad it hadn't broken. I dragged out a stepladder and put the angel back in place. I felt unsteady all day. My youngest son, Henry, had decided where to go to college, a school 2 states and 4 hours away, and I was a mixed bag of conflicted feelings, a tangled mess of holding on and letting go, wishing the years hadn't moved so swiftly. Later, I took our dog Soda for a walk and tried to sort things out, talking to myself and getting used to the idea of Henry being away. The house will feel so different without him, I thought. I came up the front walk with Soda. The angel figurine was lying in the grass once again. How is this happening? I picked up the angel, putting it on the porch windowsill this time, and went inside. As I closed the door, a bird chirped. I turned and saw a house wren perched on the high shelf, singing its heart out. Not long after, a pile of twigs grew on the porch. By morning, the wren had built a nest. I looked out the window at the figurine I'd set on the sill for safekeeping. The angel now faced the brand new nest of the bird that had nudged it out. It felt like a gift, a nudge to trust that all would be well through life's inevitable changes, that we are watched over, protected, and loved. That's all the time we have today for Guideposts. Thank you for listening. My name is Sandy Summers. Stay tuned for more great programming on Sun Sounds.